that you want to go the Dvorak route?
So, I mean, I guess I've kind of become the believer that QWERTY keyboard's just not a good design. So I brought the very clicky, nice clicky keyboard right there. Everyone can hear. Maybe a year ago, and I'd always kind of gone, I'll get a mechanical keyboard. And I thought, right, just buy it. And it's the Keychron K4, I think. Yeah, K4. I had to look at the bottom to tell you that. And it has pretty lights on it, so that's what I know. Ooh. But the thing is, when I got it, I asked some like a few people in a few different forums that I'm in, and one of them went, oh, it's hot swappable if you ever want to get into remapping. And I just thought, what's that? Because genuinely, I've never... My gaming, I think, as we've established, kind of stopped in about 2005. Mm. So my PC gaming has always been based primarily around games that you can play with a mouse. And keyboards maybe have a few hotkeys, but you don't do much with them. I was always a console person. So I was like, what's this thing? And then... I've just been like, oh, yeah, like this keyboard that just doesn't naturally kind of feel right. And I can kind of semi-touch type, not like full on 150 words a minute, not looking at the keyboard, every word is correct, touch typing, but I can kind of do it. But I'm like, oh, maybe things aren't in the right place. Maybe there is a more, but the problem then is I risk getting into the like, I'll make a start on remapping this, but then I won't finish doing it. And then I'll be perpetually stuck in a world where I've like half set up my keyboard for how long and then got bored.
You have to... No, hold on. Like, you can't just change... Oh, you mean like actually physically changing the buttons?
So all the keys... Yeah, no. All the keys you can interchange.
I know. Like my clicky keyboard is the same, but are you also like... Are you planning not only to go down the Dvorak route, but are you also planning on having like your physical keyboard have the keys to match the Dvorak keyboard as well? Is that what you think?
Well, I don't know if I'm going to go down the Dvorak route, but yeah, to do something like that.
I think you need to go either one or the other. Like you can't half-ass this. You have to commit because otherwise. Any other keyboard will become unusable to you. You're going to be like the old man that's like, you know, oh yeah, no, just quickly type in your email on this keyboard and your fingers would just retract in fear.
I would probably want to try Dvorak before, but again, it's a full keyboard, so I'd still have the number pad on the right, which I do like. That's not going to change. I'm not going to change the function. I'm not going to change the top, the function keys, because I know what all those are. It's everything else that just kind of doesn't always feel in the right place. And yeah, and I think I kind of just need to probably start by just moving. I mean, for example, one key that really bugs me is it's a Windows setup that I primarily use. It would be the Option key on a Mac. Is the Windows button. It's like... bottom, it's like one in from the bottom left, which is just not like when I'm placing my hands like at the top, I want to go up to do that, not down and like moving my hands away from where I have them to type. And I think one of my colleagues has, and I've used a few shortcuts on my phone. So for example, I have my email address. Rather than typing it every time, I just do two at symbols and it autofills. And that was a life. That was like a, what is this? One of these. It's like the if you have an iPhone. My favorite quote unquote secret about the iPhone that nobody knows, but actually quite a lot of people know, but then probably still the majority of people don't know, is the thing that if you're trying to move the cursor around a piece of text, you hold on the space bar and you can move it around. And it's one of those things that they never advertise it, but it's like. You're like, oh, I haven't got to try and awkwardly tap. So it's the same thing for me. And he's got a bunch of stuff set up on his machine where it's like loads of keyboard shortcuts and stuff. And I think my issue is that I've never been able to organise my time enough to actually sit down and go, what do I want to do? Because if I just start, I'll kind of get halfway there and then not finish.
Hey, keep in mind, so for Mac, I use Text Expander. Which does the exact same thing that you're talking about there. I have, at the beginning, I was using five expansions? Five of them. right? Yeah. Which was my email, my address, like all of these basic things that you find yourself putting in and day out. I did some custom like spelling of things because especially when you do, you know, specific tech buzzwords, mumbo jumbo, like you want it to be written in a specific way. Also my signature at my emails, I wanted to have like different ones, and obviously doing that in Outlook or in Gmail was an absolute pain in the ass. So obviously I had to figure out a different way to do that sort of stuff. So that's where Text Expander came in. Since moving to my own Mac, I haven't done it yet and I miss it every day. And it's one of those things of, I should just put in the effort and actually do it. Funnily enough, I don't feel the need to do any of that on my Windows machine, but it's because that's mostly a gaming machine versus anything else. But by the way, because you set your keyboard and I took forever and a day to actually find the name of mine, I'm using the Iquinix,
yeah. Rings a bell.
It was a present. It was a gift from my parents for my birthday. So I think that's going to tell you like what the price range of that thing is, because I didn't want to spend the money by myself. But it is a pure black, no keys on it. The keys are at the very front of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't actually, if you look at the top of the keyboard, you don't actually see any of the letters. You have to like see it at a specific angle to see the keys. So it seems completely black from the top. It's very minimalistic, and obviously that all of the colors and everything in between, and there's, you know, a whole, as all of these, it has a whole bunch of functions and everything, but it has, I have like a brown key set, and it's the most satisfying light clicky. I will record something after the show and like just put like a little snippet for people's pleasure. But it's one of those things where obviously because I primarily use it for my gaming PC, it either drives the people I play with mad, or I just from time to time hear like a satisfied sigh from some of my friends of like, oh, that keyboard sounds so good. That is also such a lame gift to ask from your parents. It's like, hey, mom and dad, hey, can you buy me a keyboard? How much is it? You don't want to know.
Well, so my other half, so it was my birthday a couple of weeks ago, and she was like, what do you want? And I have reached that point in life, and I think we probably both have, and I think I certainly hit it like in my late 20s, where when you have that something of adult money, like stuff that you want, you will just buy.
Yeah.
Like, within reason, right? The kind of stuff that it'd be reasonable to ask for a present is the kind of stuff that you would go and buy yourself when you have the money, to the point where I'm like, oh, I don't really know what I want. And I had the same conversation with my parents. They're like, well, so what do you actually want? And I was like, get me like a nice experience voucher and then we can go out for a meal or something like that. But she said, what do you want? And I was like, she's like, I want you to get something that you can open because the kids can give it to you. And I thought, right, what do I actually want?
Mm.
And she got like some novelty socks and some sweets and stuff. But I actually got a glass coffee carafe, which is a like-for-like replacement for one that I had that broke. So that you brew the coffee into it and then you can swirl it and aerate it. And I also got a porcelain tasting cup, which I don't have, but I will link it in the show notes. And it's circular, kind of, it's almost like a little bowl. And the idea is that you like pour a little bit in and you swirl it and you sip it, and it's like a wine glass but for coffee. So that's where I'm at with presents, right? So in terms of like sad presents, I mean, it's something that I wanted and I use it every day, and I have used it every single day since I got it.
I was about to say, yours sounds just pretentious, even though a £200 keyboard is also fairly pretentious. Specifically used for my gaming PC. Sounds incredibly so much so. So I'm not the one to judge. I'm not judging.
I don't know. I have a weird relationship with like birthday presents now. And again, like things that I actually want are like really expensive. And I'm like, well, no one's going to buy it. I'm not going to say to you, hey, buy me this like £500 camera lens. But at the same time, there's like nothing in that like sort of reasonable bracket that I actually want that I wouldn't just go and buy for myself.
Yep. A tip for that, because I had to learn like how to do, because I obviously like you, I have this conversation every year with my parents, with my partner, with my friends. It's just like, what do you want? And I'm like, I never want anything. Because again, I completely agree with you. Adult money, you just buy the things that you want. I have a list, like an ongoing list of things that I just like receiving as gifts, which includes, and it's not, you know, limited to mugs, nice socks, different art supplies as well. Speaking of hobbies, like, you know, that's why I think you definitely need to work on finding like a relatively cheap hobby, because yeah, it's the answer to all of the questions of like, what do you want? Because I always have something. That like, oh, that brush is really nice. I would just love to have that brush. But am I going to spend like, you know, 15 quid on the singular brush? I'm not gonna. But if anyone asks like, what do you want for your birthday? It's like, oh, here's a list. And one of those things on the list is this ridiculous expensive brush for no good reason. Other like, you know, creative hobbies of like, hey, do you want to try knitting? Do you want to try this? Like, buy me a kit for this. Trying new and interesting skills that otherwise I would see and I'll be like, oh, that would be fun. But then also I have 30 other things in the art room that are, you know, waiting for me to actually finish and work on. So no, I don't do that. But if it's a gift, it's different. And then also you give people the pleasure of seeing that you actually have used it because you didn't have a ready-made result. It's really helpful, really useful. And also, I'm sure. people like to know that you're using their gifts.
This is true. Yes. Yes,
that's why mugs and socks as well, very useful, because when you have the, and it's not that I do this for anyone listening and have gifted me a mug in my life, it's not like I choose specifically the mug that I know they've gifted me to bring on a video call. I don't do that on purpose, it just sort of happens because I obviously use them all the time, even if they're not my favorite mug.
Yeah,
you have a favorite mug too, right? It's not just me being weird.
I have mugs, so I've actually had to, I have a weird attachment to objects, but in that, like, we just brought some new exciting things. You buy some new crockery. I mean, I always thought we were going to do it when we got our kitchen redone, but apparently, no, we just have it now, and it's kind of set the colour tone for the future kitchen. But ooh, there's also that, then that kind of comes with, like, the purge of the mugs, right? There's that thing where, so, which is like, oh, uniform. But then she's like, well, do you really want to keep that university mug? I'm like, yes, I do, because I got it when I graduated, right? And there's like a mug that I got for my 18th birthday. So I have mugs that I like for different reasons, which is obviously sad. But I have favourite mugs for certain drinks and for certain uses. Although most of the mugs I like are sentimental. For sentimental reasons, I
think. But you do use them, right? Even though they're sentimental.
Yeah, mostly. I think there's one that I don't use very often. So it's a NASA mug from the Kennedy Space Center that I got when I was 11.
And it says, that is pretty special.
It says, it's even better, right? On it, it says, I need my space. Is that just not the best thing?
That is right? pretty special.
We might change on. Let's see how you feel when you've been to the Jurassic Coast.
That's fair. Yeah, no, see, you're tapping into my weakness of the sea, because I grew up on the seaside. There you go. You're gonna tap into like my innermost like childhood memories and desires to be near a sea, and you're just gonna like, you know, wrench the in there and go like, but it's so nice here, isn't it? And you're gonna make me question my decisions in life. And the nice weather as well is definitely gonna change. Mind you, I truly believe that I appreciate the nice weather because up here it's not nice all the time. Otherwise, I would be ungrateful, as I think most people down south are. It's like, oh, it's so warm. It's like, you have no idea how good you have it.
Yeah, I think being people down south tend to be English who like just complaining about the weather anyway. And it's like, it's either too warm. It's always like, I think maybe like 15 degrees Celsius is about the right temperature for someone who's English. It's either too cold or it's too hot.
16 with no wind, sunshine. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like that's perfect weather. And mind you, again, we're very lucky in the UK. We tend to have that quite a lot.
We do.
Growing up in Bulgaria, like, because Bulgaria is one of those countries in Europe that's we get both extremes. We get very hot summers and very cold winters. So that's perfect temperature and weather-wise was very rare. And that's why I would always say like spring and autumn are my favorite seasons, because that is when you get like those couple of weeks of just like, this is perfect. Like it's just, this is, can it be like this? And then suddenly, you know, either scorching sun or hailing winds of the north come through, and it's just like, oh goodness. Okay, never mind. We're good now. That's why I really appreciated like coming to the UK. It was one of those things of like, oh, this is very lovely. It's very mild. But when I was living down south, it's like, it's very mild. Yet over summer, why is it 35 degrees and where's the aircon? Because obviously summer doesn't exist in British people's minds. And it's just new. This is the... I lived in relatively new buildings, right, when I was down south.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they not build them with aircon already in... What? Answer me this, Paul. You live very south.
I do. Yeah, I live in a house that's not that old, relatively. It was built in the late 70s.
No, late 70s, that's fair, right? That's fair. But I'm talking like brand new buildings that are like, you know, we're the first people coming into the building.
I don't know. I don't know whether or not built with aircon. Ah! And they're still built to retain heat.
Yes! Again,
because
I
get it gets
it up
really
here.
Cold. Yeah. Probably the answer is probably because we're cheap and we don't like spend... And I think it's like we like getting to the summer because it's like, oh, we can turn the heating off. If you then go, oh, now you've got to turn the aircon on, it's like expensive all year round. Whereas at least in the summer, you go, right, now is the time I can save a bit of money to try and get through the winter. Maybe that's
what. I don't know. Again, in Bulgaria, we had both. We had an aircon for summer and we have a heater for winter. Like that's how like I've lived my whole life. And it was so jarring to come down. Like again, because I thought the UK was going to be similar to Denmark, right? Where it's... The hottest it would be is the 3 days of summer in Denmark, which is like 25 degrees. So I'm like, yeah, that's fine, right? I can live. Like, for those 3 days, I'll just be outside, right? Just nonstop. And that's fine. Yeah. That's livable.
Yeah.
And I thought coming down south to the UK, it would be very similar. And then the first summer I was here, it was like 36 or 37. And I'm just like, Jesus. Like,
yeah.
I am melting.
Uh-huh.
And there's no respite.
There's no respite. And it's the only... It's funny because there are... I've had colleagues and people I've known from Texas who have come to the UK and gone, the UK... And Australia, like, the UK heat is just different. And I'm like, yeah, thank you.
It is.
Like, I don't dispute that 45 degrees centigrade is objectively hotter.
Yeah.
But... And it is the, like, you know, opening the doors and it's like opening the oven... It's like when you open the oven door and it gets a wave of heat.
Yeah, but it's a dry oven.
It's a dry oven, yeah. It's not wet. It's not damp air. It's like... But it's funny, because talking about aircon in the UK, and I am feeling a tingy bit nostalgic for my days spent working in networking and IT, because the best thing, and actually, particularly when I spent a year working for a law firm, and their whole thing was they were a high street law firm. So they had all these very old, like Victorian offices all on high streets. Horrendously hot. Either boiling hot or freezing cold. No, some of them didn't even have central heating in. But one of them, they'd made a significant investment to actually build a server room. And the server room had aircon. And they had no windows, right? But it had aircon. And no one else could go in there. And I remember going in like the height of summer, going to that office and being like, I can just sit in the server room for an hour because it's just nice in here and no one disturbs me.
I'm so happy we have this shared experience.
Of sitting in server rooms being
sitting in
lovely.
Server rooms, yeah.
listening to the hum and the beep.
Exactly. It was so nice because, so the first office I was in the UK was practically like an old airplane hangar turned into office.
Yeah.
Very cool, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was the best. It was right next to an airport, so we had like the whole airport for ourselves. So when obviously all of the sales colleagues would buy like really expensive sports cars, like they would go test them on the airport and we would get to drive in them. It was great. But the other benefit, the drawback to that is that, you know, airport like plane hangars are made of metal. And even with the insulation on the inside and made to look like a nice office, gosh, did it retain heat like nothing else. even though it was this big open space, there was just no air circulation whatsoever in that huge office. It was like an open floor space, which, by the way, for the networking team was just awful because we were literally between sandwiched in the most disgusting sandwich ever between the sales team, right? Open floor sales team and the marketing team behind us. So we were in a fantastic place, but hey, you know, I guess it worked for some people. But that's why we were very often just nested, all of us together. It's like, oh, something happened in the server room. Like, we need to go check it. Like, come, you know, you need to go come with us as well. Come. And like all six of us would just like slouch away into the server room and just sit there for a bit. just to cool down.
I do remember being... that one of the jobs, like, that we, every week, one of the jobs was to, and this is the thing is, it was, again, it was like about like a 20-25 minute drive to and from this office, from the office I was based in, but was to, we were still running tape backups, proper offsite backups, but on a Friday after, like Friday sort of just after lunchtime, the job was to go and change the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone's, and if you've ever like seen a mag, you think, oh, my dad takes us really old, it's still a very reliable way of backing up securely, because the job, you would drive to the office, you go in the server room, you change out the tapes, and then you take the tapes that you'd taken out to the lockup where they went in a safe, and then you kind of drive back to the office. So this is probably like, you could make it last about 3.5 hours if you wanted to, and blame the quote unquote traffic. The other favourite thing I used to do was, we had an office on the Isle, so this was based in Portsmouth. We had an office on the Isle of Wight, and there was always a thing that they felt quite isolated and never got visited. And there's only like 5 people based there, but to go to the Isle of Wight was like easily half a day, because you would drive down to the seafront, you'd get on the hovercraft, which is really funny because it's one of those things, it's like the only commercial hovercraft in the world, and the first couple of times you do it, like, wow, this is so cool, what a hovercraft, and then after a couple of times you're like, yeah, this is just what I do. But there's obviously all the people there that are like tourists on their holiday going, this is a hovercraft going over the sea, and I'm just like, yeah, it's cool, I'm just doing this all the time, you know, it's cool. But again, great way to go, oh no, I missed the hover. Oh, it's not on for an hour. Oh, what a shame. Oh, I'll have to go get some chips by the beach.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm going to go grab a coffee and just enjoy the seaside for a second.
It was good. It was a good time.
Why did we move to Breezels again?
No, I don't know. I have to work now.
Yeah, exactly. It's this funny thing of like, as humans we tend to do this, right? Where we're looking back, we have a lot more rose tinted glasses on things we've done before than we have of the reality of today. Like, mind you, like, I am not planning, nor do I have any desire to go back to a network engineering career. If I must, I will. But there isn't a bone in my body that wants to go back into a cold server room where like the only place to sit is on the floor. For the next 3 hours, just, you know, console cabling into everything and just trying to make sure, and like the stress of like, why is it everything? I'm not selling networking very well, by the way. It's a cool job, folks. It's really, really cool. It's just one of those things where you really need to enjoy the technical side of it. I enjoyed the challenge of it. I enjoyed those, again, at a certain age, to a certain degree, like, I enjoyed the challenge of like, something is broken, needs to get fixed, how do we resolve it? And I always caught myself like not really interested in the technical side of how do we resolve it. I was always in the, okay, we have 3 people, this is the problem, this is the impact, this is how the things are affecting, like, this is what we need to prioritize first, sort of thing. So that was my joy of it, alongside with learning the tech, because the tech is also cool. But the aircon was the best.
It's such a shallow reason for me, when I think, well, why did we move into pre-sales? And immediately money. In my head, literally, but you know what? It was the meme. It was the Sponge, the Mr. Krabs from SpongeBob meme. Hello, I like money. Why have you opened another restaurant? Money. And I'm like, yeah, that's why. Money. Basically, because just go. But literally, there's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah. No.
Why is anyone in a sales career?
Oh yeah, no, money. No, but hold on. Nobody's in a sales career because they like people.
No.
If anyone tells you that, they're absolutely full of there is no such thing. Including, right? If and I will say this like very like gladly, if network engineering paid as much as pre-sales, I would have never moved. Right? The only reason I jumped ship so readily was that VMware, like, practically flaunted at me a whole wad of cash. And was like, join us! And I'm like, oh! Right?
I will say, when I moved into pre-sales, it was not motivated by money, but money has absolutely kept me in pre-sales.
Yeah, no, mine was entirely based on money.
Okay, fair enough. And I think it's important because this can be a very lucrative career, and I think it's hard to not kind of. I think the problem I find is that you end up working in a lucrative career with people that are like salespeople who are the best paid people in pretty much any company apart from the executive team. And sometimes even, you know, if you have a salesperson who's crushing their quota, maybe even making more than your CEO, potentially, right? That's not an unheard of scenario.
Yeah. Not for long, but hey.
Not for long. No. But it once, maybe like 1 month or 1 year, yeah. Until the CEO gets their bonus. But it's that kind of thing. If you kind of go, oh, but actually it's a perfectly valid thing. And I think it's something that people don't like talking about. And it's like, but that's a perfectly valid reason to like being in this job. And yeah, I have
no shame about this, by the way. No. But that doesn't take away from the fact that after I got into pre-sales and after I realized what this thing actually is that this is actually pretty cool. And then the passion kicked in and then the care kicked in. And this is like, but again, I don't hide it at all. Like, it was definitely Oh, I don't know, because like I liked the place I was working at. I was, you know, I was working on really interesting projects. Like, I was learning a lot of really cool, interesting tech. And then, you know, come July 2020, VMware came strolling in, flashing some dollar bills at me, and I'm like, well, off I go. I mean, when they almost like 2.5x my salary, it's like, oh yeah, no, this is practically a deal I cannot say no to. Like, I would be silly. But then also, looking back, I was incredibly undercharged, like undercharging for what I was doing. But hey,
that's a separate topic. I think, yeah,
that's a complete separate topic. That, yeah. But like, when you're first coming into pre-sales and then you see the humongous difference from being on the field engineer and then pre-sales, you don't think to ask, can I have more? Because it's such a stark difference, especially vendor, right? I think it's different from partner and like reseller side, because I was working for a reseller. But jumping into vendor, and vendor world is a completely different ballgame overall. At that point, it's like, whoa. I don't know, mind. I know I sound very Eastern European when I say these things, but like, money really matters when it comes to these things. When your whole life you have been told that you need to figure out a way to get the maximum amount of money out of your career, because otherwise you'll be on the streets. Your mentality is very driven in that sense. You don't get the luxury of, and this is why, again, very, I'll sound incredibly Eastern European, but all of these Western people, when they kept on saying like, oh no, you need to. Pick a career that you enjoy doing, right? You need to do, and I'm like, you are absolutely out of your mind. Like, if I was doing, I wouldn't work if I was gonna do what I enjoy doing, because like, I like doing art stuff, and guess what? A career in art is not profitable in any way, shape, or form. Most artists become rich after they die, and I'm not planning on doing that.
Yeah, it's that, or they just work some other job.
Yeah.
Until, yeah. And it's fine.
Not until. If, right? Because it's a very small percentage of all artists become, quote unquote, wildly successful. And even then, you're absolutely right. The revenue streams are definitely not uniform. It's not just from the art. They're definitely doing some other stuff on the side. And or generational wealth, which I don't think either you and me have the luxury of. So,
No. Unfortunately not. But I don't want to get started on that. But that's, I think, and it's the same in the arts in general, the same in music, where you see, and I have some kind of mutual friends with people in bands who are playing arenas because of who I grew up with. But I'm like, these guys don't have loads of money.
Yeah.
And if anything, you look at it and go, yeah, they've been doing this for like 15, 16 years for basically nothing. And in only the last 3 years have they actually started making any kind of money from it. In some ways, I actually feel the same thing about like our kind of respective paths into pre-sales. Like for a long time, I was like, as much as I enjoyed what I did not make very much money whatsoever. So this kind of, whilst the jumps have been big, if it actually, when you kind of level it out across how long I've been working and like where I, the sort of, you go, oh, well, actually, you know, it's just that I've been fortunate to kind of take a couple of significant increases through some moves, but that's because it was kind of artificially sort of suppressed for like the first 5 years of my career. Yeah. It really was, it started from a very low point. So if I'd started from where a lot of my friends did, yeah, it would still be, you know, very high, it would still be very good, but it would be less of a jump than what it
Yeah, yeah, the been. Contrast between the different phases yeah. of that career would have been less.
Exactly.
I'm one of those people, right? So I was incredibly lucky that just at the time when I was getting into my first career, like role in the UK, I was just I had a bargaining chip, which was like another vendor wanted me at the time to go join them. So I had as my first job ever, I was given a very lucrative offer. Just the idea was that I had to move to the Netherlands and I didn't want to do that. So I just took that offer and took it to the company I was working for at the time as an intern and just said, like, I want to stay with you. This is what they're offering me. Make it make sense for me to stay here. And they did, mm-hmm. right? And it wasn't loads of money, mind you, but it was above the average UK salary. So I was like, yeah, this makes, mm-hmm. you know, for a first role, I've nailed this, right? I am super happy with that. Then the jump to pre-sales was still incredibly jarring because of the contrast between those two roles. Mm. To put it into perspective, and I always give this example for, and it's not in the sense of to demotivate people who are in a very technical role, because like my partner is in a very technical role and he's been in networking for what now, 12, 13 years. So he mm-hmm. has a relatively very successful career with a little bit of a, you know, with a slowdown for a couple of years. But in general, he's been moving quite fast. He, at the time when I joined VMware, we were earning the same,
mm-hmm.
right? And it was technically my, what, fourth year into my career? Mm-hmm. So that could either be quite demotivating for technical people, or it could be just another proof on the point of like, you know, oh, if the moment you touch sales, the moment you have to talk to people, the moment you have to stop doing just the things you enjoy and on the technical side, mm-hmm. that is the point where money starts rolling in. And that's, unfortunately, that's true. Right. Fortunately mm-hmm. or unfortunately, depends on what your, you know, value. But again, I'm sure one of my topics for today was actually to like talk about why networking is cool. And I've done a really crap job at selling it. Like, it's really hard. Like, you have to stay in like these crappy server rooms and you get paid shit.
But you don't have to talk to people. So that's
because you don't have to talk to people until something breaks and you're part until of the support
breaks.
Team.
Until something breaks.
I want to ask you about Motion, because you told me over a phone call that you are using Motion. Talk to me about Motion. You've paid the subscription.
I paid the subscription for a month. So because I just didn't cancel it. We are not sponsored by Motion, but we are open to sponsorships. I actually feel like Motion, I have maybe found in Motion a good use of quote unquote AI in my life. And that is because I've posted on LinkedIn about my kind of my neurodivergence, and I am diagnosed as autistic. I am not diagnosed as having ADHD. So I'm very sensitive to going, yes, I have ADHD. But the reality is there's kind of quite a lot of things I go, maybe I do. And one of those things is I am good at making lists of things to do. This is what I have to do. I am terrible at executing on those things. With Motion, I'm like, oh, all of a sudden, I'm getting stuff done because it's like I'm having somebody tell me, this is when you need to do stuff. And I've never really worked in a job, apart from when I was like a teenager in high school and college, when you're like working in retail and someone's like, go and do this for 4 hours. Office jobs don't come with that structure. They kind of come with like people chucking a bunch of tasks at you. And actually, as I've kind of gone on in my career and gone up and become more senior, you have less and less and less and less of people telling you what to do, and more and more and more you have to work out what's important for yourself, which is absolutely fine. But for somebody who like has a inherent the paralysis with planning my day, that's a real problem. And we talked about time blocking in the episode where we discussed productivity, and I'd never done it, and I'd never thought, and I think my thing was, my barrier to time blocking was it requires me to sit down and block some time. What I have found with Motion, the fact that I can say, here are the tasks I have to do, this is their importance, and this is how long they take, and then it plans it into my calendar, is like, oh, hang on, I'm suddenly getting stuff done, and it's, some of it is like those little things, like send this person an update on this area, or write up this piece of information, or send out these meeting minutes. And what I'm no longer having is that like block of the I was using Microsoft Viva, the thing in Office where it blocks your quote unquote focus time around your calendar appointments, but that just gives you like a 2-hour block of focus time. And you're like, well, this doesn't tell me what I should be doing. What should I be focusing on? I've got 2 days. Oh, I don't know. And by the time I've kind of, I'm like, I might get like 2 things done on that list and then spend the rest of the time deciding what order to do other things in and what's important and not getting things done. And Motion has, for now, has solved that. And it's kind of a bit frustrating because I've kind of obviously paid for a month. I'm away next week, so I won't be using it at all. But I am finding myself getting stuff done. And I'm putting in, I'm slowly building it out. I'm putting in projects. I actually, again, there's stuff I didn't realize, like the fact that it has a booking page you can create. I've only ever used the free version of Calendly because I've been like, I can't justify spending whatever that cost is per month for that one service. But the fact that it's bundled into Motion with all the other stuff, I'm like, oh, well, actually, this is something I've always wanted and now I have it. And there's just lots of like little things that I didn't realize Motion had. Like setting, I want to do this thing twice a week in this block of time. Oh, okay. It's very, so the kind of the deeper I get with it, the more I'm like, maybe this is the actual answer to the question. A, what is the productivity tool I've been looking for? And B, what is it a good use of AI? And it's quite boring when you go, oh, it's actually just scheduling stuff for me. But I've kind of had this, and we touched on it when we talked about AI, this thing of everyone expected it to be this like game-changing thing. It's going to start, everyone focused on the like the generative stuff, the art and the written stuff and the video, which is all quite just gimmicky. It's actually just not very good, and kind of doesn't really, kind of, it's quite shallow. But actually, this is maybe a really good use. And I don't know if AI is like, it's just the branding, right? If it wasn't for the AI kind of boom, it would not be called an AI-enabled thing. It would just be called machine learning or like an automated planner. But it is like having, it is genuinely, it's like having a PA or an EA who's saying to me, here's a list of things you have to do and this is when you should do them. And as I check stuff off doing it, it's then moving things around for me. And, you know, I'm looking and going, you know, this week I'm actually going to get to go to the gym twice this week, which is something I've not been able to do for ages because I've just not, I've not been planning my time well enough to do that.
And that helps. And Motion really helps with that.
Yeah.
Whilst we were speaking, because I tried Motion, I think maybe when it was a little bit too early. It was still mm-hmm. early days for it. And I think the thing I didn't like about it was how it was trying to do everything and anything all in one without really being good at any of them in particular.
Mm-hmm.
It was trying to be like my task management system. It was trying to be my calendar manager. It was trying to do this. It was trying to do that. And I was managing at the time multiple calendars as well because I had my personal, mm-hmm. I had my work one. And I think I just didn't give it a proper chance to really give it a go. So now, especially since, you know, the conversation we had yesterday and you seeing so much benefit from it, I have decided to give it another go. And which, funnily enough, now to think about it, like I also have like a week of travel next week, but that doesn't, like I still, like, but yeah, you're doing a different travel to me. Like I'm just doing like a regular travel to go see my parents. I still use my calendar throughout that time because I still do some work when I'm doing that. So I'll still give it a proper go. And I think especially when it comes to navigating tasks that need to do around travel, I think that's going to be also like a really good use case for me, just to give it a go.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to hear it's working for you.
It's good. I think I'm still using Todoist on my phone, but I've used Zapier, which allows you to build an integration between Todoist and Motion. So it will add stuff in. Cause the thing that Motion doesn't have from a UX standpoint is that, and the reason I use Todoist is, and I don't use reminders in my phone, is because of the kind of the synchronicity here. I'm working cross platform as well. I can open my phone, I have my Todoist widget on my homepage, I can type in a note, and it will then sync that to Motion. And I then have every day, I have a 5-minute action in Motion every workday to go in and basically to check my unscheduled tasks, which are everything from Todoist. And I can go in, edit them, go, right, okay, these are all things I have to do. Motion, please plan them into my day and then complete them at Todoist. Now, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get the integration to work so that it, and it probably is possible, I just haven't sort of closed the loop on it, is where add it in Todoist, it creates it in Motion, it deletes it, completes it in Todoist. And that is like an automated cycle. Because at the moment, the kind of slightly clunky aspect of that workflow is I have to go back into Todoist and go either complete or done. But then that's kind of fine, right? Because I just go, you know what? Just clear it out.
I was about to say, like, that feels like a task that you can do at the end of the week, sort of, to make sure, because these integrations, as good as they are, they're not perfect. And I think it's a really good sort of sense of accomplishment as well for you, sort of look at, you know, post the week where you have all of these tasks in and just go like, oh yeah, I did do all of these. Click, 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 you know, ting, 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 get all the satisfying noises of actually checking them through Todoist. If folks are wondering, you know, for Todoist, and I think, you know, whilst I don't use Todoist, but I think over time, your systems are overtaking my life, and I don't know if I appreciate that. But what Todoist does really well is the natural language. And I think we spoke about this quite a lot in the AI episode, because I think that's something that's really undersold as one of their functions, which is just, you can tell Todoist something like, prepare lunch next Thursday. And it will do all of the metadata around what is next Thursday. It would set up a time at noon, right? So it would make sure that, you know, automatically it would fill in a lot of the things of you just... Because you can also just speak at it, right? If you're using like the voice assistants. So it's incredibly easy to just, whatever is on your head, just quickly jot it down on Todoist. And I really like your integration with because I was thinking, like, how am I going to do that if I am to, you know, if I do that... Because right now I'm doing it manually, right? So I'm on Google Calendar. I go in and I time block by myself. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to try with Motion that instead of me sort of grabbing and, you know, sort of pushing down and putting like a chunk of time, I'll just let it do it for me in accordance and around all of the other bits and pieces I already have in there. Funnily enough, I think it's post being incredibly into the Apple ecosystem, it asked me for a couple of like, oh, can we have full access to your contact list and send emails in your stead and do this and do that? And I'm like, no, you may not.
you can just
look. you can't touch. So let's leave it as that.
No, I agree. And I have added, because it does, again, I think a clincher for me is it manages multiple calendars.
Yeah.
What I can't quite yet work out is, and this is a very specific thing for me, is I have is adding a shared family calendar, which I think it's included, but I can't quite tell. But in principle, right, like you, I have my and this has been a perennial problem, is I have my work one and I have my personal one, and they don't always synchronize, and I don't kind of copy over stuff. Because it's generally 95% of the time, the personal one is weekends, work one is weekdays. So it doesn't really become an issue. But there's that 5% where it becomes really annoying, where I'm like, it's like, my other half will go, it's in the calendar. And I'm like, I know, but it's not in my work one, which is the one that is the Tuesday. And I'm looking at this one and I'm not looking at the personal one. So again, it's probably one of those things that, actually, I could just create a 10-minute recurring task every Friday to go, or add it to my weekly review, go cross-check calendar for next week.
Yep.
And I think I'm sort of trying to find a happy place between like semi full automation and fully manual, and go, you know what, there are some things that the effort of trying to automate is just not worth it, and just do it manually, because that's just easier. So yeah, that's my experience of Motion, and I think I'm going to stick with it, and I think if I still have it after a month, I'm going to buy it for a year, because I kind of, it felt a little bit too much to go for the year. I was like, but it definitely, if I'm still using it after a month, it will be embedded enough in my workflow to want to keep it.
Yep.
And I'm not doing it from the like, oh, I'll get 25% more done every week, or finish 5 hours early, because maybe so. It's more just not feeling a perpetual sense of panic that I've forgotten something, or I'm not going to get stuff done, or I'm not going to get to go for a walk today, or I'm not going to get to have lunch. And just having that structure has just, I've just kind of felt this really weird sense of relief. And like, you know what, I'm stuff's getting done, and it's fine, because I'm looking and I'm kind of going, oh, I've got this thing I've got to do by this date, but I put it into Motion, and it's like, yeah, here's when you'll do it.
Yeah, it will find the time. It will find the time for you. Yeah, which is really, really important. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm really, really happy that you've one, discovered it, and two, is really working for you. I'll let you know if I'm getting some success with it. I might be a little bit more, because again, like, I was already doing bulk scheduling, so. But I'll see how useful this is to me, if it's worth actually, you know, using the service. Again, I might not be their perfect customer, right? Which is absolutely fair. And it has nothing, you know, it says nothing against the product. It's just where I think you and I are on different places when it comes to like managing and organizing our time, which is absolutely fine. By the way, Paul, I feel like I should be advertising this, and I'm doing a really bad job at it for multiple reasons. But I'm speaking at DemoFest.
Woo! You are.
I am.
I'm excited. Self-proclaimed
DemoFest poster child.
Of course, absolutely. The
I'm collecting Pokemons. I'm collecting highest, all the DemoFests.
Highest rated DemoFest speaker, I think. I believe. Is that right?
Oh. At London.
Yeah. And this is the chance for me to tell. So we've told the story on the podcast before, but that it was in London that Lydia and I first met, and I was kind of aware of the stuff that you'd done at Dublin and people posting and raving about it, and I was like, oh, this is the session I absolutely have to go to. And I went in there, and my first memory of you is being stood at the front going, please somebody close the door. There's too many people in this room. People are still coming in, and I want to start. And then obviously absolutely just like doing this incredible presentation that I think just kind of floored everybody a little bit. And genuinely, I just kind of walking out of it and kind of going, oh, okay, this is now like kind of put a different perspective on the rest of the day. And there were then some other, like, there were some really, really good sessions kind of through the rest of it. The other thing I remember, and I won't say who, but another friend of mine was presenting that day, who came up to me and was like, how did she get away with not using the, like, branded consensus deck? And you were like, oh, I just submitted it really late so they couldn't change it. I mean, fair enough, right? And then there was the top most memorable thing was you panicking at the start of the presentation. The second most memorable thing actually about a day was the fire drill.
Yes. Which, oh my goodness, so I'm so happy it didn't happen during my session.
It happened like just after the end of your session,
Yeah.
It's like you kind of were like, it was like, oh, we need a fire drill because everyone just needs to go outside to recover from this presentation. Get some fresh air. And eat some nice cookies.
Yes, yeah. Personal branding on point.
Absolutely, I know. No, but join demo. I mean, I think DemoFest is a really. I first attended demo. I think it was the first DemoFest 4 years ago, and like now, obviously, it's become much bigger. But yeah, what is your session about, Lydia, at DemoFest?
That's a very good question. People who know me will very quickly realize that, like many of the things I do in my life, including Demofest. I leave things very last minute because if I... Okay, let me be very clear. I don't leave things last minute because I procrastinate. That's not what I do. I'm obviously a very productive and very organized person, and that's not what... You know, yeah, definitely. What happens is that if I... No, hold on. If I plan or put a lot of effort way ahead of time... I remember it was actually the first one I did in London when I was talking to Patrick Pissang, friend of the show, Patrick Pissang, when he told me that he has been preparing and rehearsing his session for weeks. I had a little mini panic attack because I'm like, I wrote this crap last week. and so the method behind my madness is that if I pre-prepare, and this happened, by the way, for Dublin, I was like, okay, I am traveling, quote unquote, abroad. Well, not quote unquote, it was actually traveling abroad for a session. I need to take this seriously, right? People are going to be flying in there. There's going to be, like, this is a serious thing. I need to, you know, do like my due diligence. So I prepped 3 months in advance. I had the session outlined. I had everything ready. It was ready to go. And then 2 weeks before the show, before Demofest, I decided that I hated everything about it and rewrote the whole thing. So I decided to just skip the effort of rewriting things again. I have a plan of what I want to talk about, obviously, because I obviously need to write the, you know, the title and the summary and everything else. But it's still very much things on the whiteboard, you know, sticky notes all over the place until practically next week, most likely, when I panically I'm gonna just sort of prepare for everything all at once. And also because I'm going to be using my new setup, which Paul, you know all about, but nobody else does. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be kept a secret until Demofest because I want it to be a huge surprise for people. I didn't know if it was going to work until last week. So I was sort of like waiting to see if I would have the tech behind what I want to do before the actual session. But in summary, the session is all going to be about, you know, because obviously, and you will see this, and I actually have a couple, a listed of recommended sessions too for folks that are interested in seeing other folks other than me, which I highly recommend you do. Please don't just listen to my session. It would be incredibly boring if you do that. Demofest is amazing. Please, 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 please. There's a lot of awesome speakers that are going to be on the 3 days, so it's a 3-day event. So definitely, you know, take some time away from work if you can. You know, not take obviously days off, but sort of like, tell your boss, tell your colleagues, I'm going to be learning how to be, you know, an even better pre-sales person via this these presentations, because they're always amazing and there's always too much content to sort of look into. So you really need to cherry pick what you want to do first. I don't think the timings have been released yet. Obviously, I know my timing, but that's because obviously I need to book the time. But it's spread across. It starts from the afternoon in the UK, because obviously it's starting to spread.
Yeah, I think it starts at 7 or 8 a.m. Pacific time, which is like it's sort of mid-afternoon UK.
Yeah.
But the good thing in the virtual one, the sessions are recorded.
They are.
Go and catch them up.
And they do release them, yeah. They do release them fairly quickly after the event as well. So they've been fantastic. You know, Consensus have been amazing with that. So they do that. But why am I beating around the bush? So my session... I know why I'm beating around the bush, because it's going to sound incredibly half-assed and I'm going to do a really bad job of advertising myself. But it is really all about communication whiteboarding in the era of AI. That's been obviously, you know, it was one of the many reasons the conversation we had last time prompted, you know, us talking about AI. It's been a lot of on my mind, and it's more about how do you find that balance and how do you keep to the things that you think are important in the day-to-day role, you know, talking to people, selling to people, convincing people, when you have all of these tools constantly being shoved, you know, in your face. You need to be doing this, you need to be doing that. Oh, you're not using this, you're obviously a failure, like, please do this. So it's just about sort of re-energizing people that all is not lost. Your role is important. The things you are doing are quite important. And it's just about sort of, hopefully, and that's my hope, motivating and enthusiasing people again to use practical tools with cool, you know, adding a little bit of tech here and there, adding a little bit of flair here and there, a bit of magic, a little bit of sparkle, just to get through you know, the fights that we do have of getting people to, you know, getting our customers, our potential prospects into what is important to them and actually getting our products in place, you know, and doing, at the end of the day, feeling satisfied that what we do is important and what we do is a good job, which is, I think, really, really hard when you're, again, constantly bombarded by these, you know, tooling and everything. Did I sell it to you?
You did.
I also have a list of folks that I am personally very excited to see at DemoFest. First of all, Paul, why did you not submit a session for DemoFest?
I presented actually at DemoFest 2 years ago now, which feels crazy. And I would love to present again. It's grown massively since I participated. And it's funny, I look back at my session, which was all about how pre-sales, bear in mind, this is May 2022, I will say, pre-sales needs to become content creators. And we need to focus in on creating engaging content that prospects and customers are going to want to buy. And it's almost like we're now in a world where that's a discussion that we're having. I did consider it, and I think genuinely I couldn't land on a topic that I was like, this really compels me to talk about this year.
Yep.
And I think that also I've just had lots of other things going on that I've been like, actually, you know what? What I really enjoyed about the London Demo Fest was that I wasn't presenting because I didn't have the pressure. And I think about this actually an event that I was at with work quite recently. And one of the conversations the three of us that attended took away because we were exhibiting at this event and it was fine. You know, we had some good conversations with some customers and potential prospects and kind of other people in the industry. But we all said, you know, in the evaluation, you know what, next year we could just go as attendees because it's a super interesting event. But whenever you're, and I'm speaking to someone who's presenting, but the problem is when you're doing something, when you're a part of an event, that is what you focus on.
Yes.
And it's very difficult to take in the rest of the event because that's all you think about.
Which is hugely unfortunate because I'm always very happy that I tend to be relatively early in the day. I don't know if that's going to continue being a trend. I hope it does because it's really helpful. But because it then allows me for the rest of the day to focus on other people's content, which otherwise I would, because they would change. If I listen to someone that I admire or look up to in the pre-sale space, it's going to affect the way I'm going to present later in my own content, which might be a bad or a good thing, right? Who knows? But it feels like I'm not doing them then the due diligence of paying attention to what they are trying to convey and focus on my own little world. Sort of like, you know, when you're having a conversation with someone and all you think about is what you're going to say next, that doesn't make you a good listener, right? So you need to really focus on what other people are saying. So I know exactly what you mean about being an attendee versus being a presenter. I haven't been an attendee only in the live events. Maybe I should. I'm still on the. You know, I don't know if I should be. You know, if I should put a session forward for London, if I should put a session forward for Dublin. Like, I'm still a little bit on the fence there. I don't know. You know, time will tell what my decision is going to be on that one. I'll be there. That's besides the point. But it's just more about, like, should I be then, like, taking airspace? Because, again, there's been so much, you know, I've been in all of them from where I stand. It's like, oh, come on. Like, take a backseat for a bit. Like, be like Paul and be reasonable and just, like, listen to people from time to time. Don't just talk.
That's not like me, though, because I just talk all the time on this. This is going out the week of Demo Fest. I'm just looking now at the topics and the speakers, and aside from yours, I'm gonna pick out four others just from the list.
Oh, I wonder if we'll match. Go on.
So then these are ones that grab me. Okay. Yep. So Vinegar and Oil pre-sales and partners, obviously very close to
that's,
my heart.
That's one of mine as well. It's from Renato Bonomini.
Renato, who's a VP of sales engineering at Content Wise. Sounds super interesting. I'm really interested to see Stefan Brett Schneider. I worked with Stefan when I was at IFS.
Ah, right.
He's the global director of pre-sales transformation. Funnily enough, the guy that introduced me to Miro was Stefan. So his consensus crime, 6 ways to sabotage your pre-sales revolution, I think again would be quite interesting. And I, having been at IFS when they were introducing consensus, I'm interested to see where they are now, 2.5 years on, and obviously the time since I was there. I'm going to say Ron Whitson's one is grabbing me, about building an associate SC program to diversify pre-sales and ignite growth. Ron is a super, super compelling speaker. I know
Ron
him personally.
Ron is fantastic.
And he's just
and that topic
this...
makes a lot of sense for you as well as a leader of people.
Again, and I think this thing, I'm speaking as a leader, I'm thinking if you're someone coming into this as going, thinking about, like, again, this is my thing. And I would say, one more. I'm going to go with Julie Hanson's, which is leveling up your video outreach. Julie, again,
she's absolutely brilliant.
Incredible. Right, absolutely incredible presenter, and I think has a real gift for explaining how to use video and stuff. And I think, as again, as someone who is heavily invested in video, and I think, again, if I'm picking, like, again, 5 sessions is probably still a lot to attend, but those are the 5, so those 4 plus you, I'd recommend. I would say, obviously, there are some incredible speakers on here. You know, everybody should go to Bill's session, everyone should go to Chris White's session, to Peter Cohen's session, because, you know, particularly if you're an IC and if you have not heard and Kerry and Natasha, if you have not heard these speakers before, if you've not attended one of their sessions, it will change your perspective dramatically.
Yeah. No, those are the heavy hitters, I would
the
say.
The heavy hitters, I would say, are like those people. And kind of, but I would particularly encourage people that have not attended DemoFest before or that have not heard them speak before.
Yeah.
I would say if you have, look at this, like, it's funny enough, I kind of look at it a little bit like if you're going to a festival mm-hmm. and you look at the lineup and go, oh, there's so many bands that I want to watch and I can only watch like 15% of them.
Yep.
You're drawn to the headliners, right?
And I think those are the headliners.
They are the headliners. If you haven't seen them before, go and watch them.
Yes.
But if you have, I would encourage you, look at the analogy would be like the second and third stage, or the people slightly down, not to obviously devalue, but the people that have not presented these before or as often, are not as well known in the industry. Go and check them out, because some of my favourite festival experiences have been people who, to make DemoFest examples, obviously your session, right? And 4 years ago, there was a session on storytelling by a guy called Mark Green. I'm not sure what happened to him, but he was working at Sage at the time. Yeah. Anyway, I still remember it to this day. I think he's doing something. He went to work for some company. I'm not really sure what they're called. But again, it's those things. If there's a title that grabs you that's of intrigue, go and check that one out. I think, again, one bonus one, right? And again, someone who I know of, which is Malcolm Murphy from Mimecast.
Oh.
He's doing a session on great interview questions. If you are attending as somebody who is either wanting to break into this career or who is looking to make a move, absolutely go to that session, because it will be
really,
really
insightful. Oh, and he's a fantastic speaker as well.
Yeah.
He's so easy to listen to. I completely agree with you on the frontliner analogy as well. The amount of content I watched from all of the above that we mentioned, like the heavy hitters, it's ridiculous. They're not on my list because they are the heavy hitters, because they are the default people to go watch on these events. So that's why, like, I want to use sort of this platform to highlight a couple of other folks. The one exception I did make for this, and I'm happy you mentioned him, was Bill, because I have a soft spot for Bill. I think his ideas are controversial and radical in, like, the flavor that I enjoy. And also, he is one of the people that when I first joined, he was like one of my first mentors. So I have an incredible soft spot for Bill, and I will always like, and he sort of took a little bit of a step back the last couple of years, and now he's coming back on the stage when it comes to pre-sales, and I'm so excited to see what he has to say about that. The vinegar and oil, the pre-sales and the partners, that's something obviously with your day job you have a keen interest when it comes to, like, the partner ecosystem. I have a love for the partner ecosystem, so I am very curious to see what Renato has to say. The two other sessions I have there is Roman Michubovsky. the best you prioritizing real success. That one, again, it feels like one of those ones that are going to like tug at a heartstring and are going to be something a little bit more different from the default. We're just going to be talking about pre-sales and how to be better with pre-sales. And the other one is Tony Frantic. I quite like Tony as well. The stoic pre-sales professional. Again, he's one of those folks that I really appreciate their different view and different opinion on things. So I cannot wait to see what he has to say on that. Because, again, I have a very... not negative, but sort of like controversial opinion about stoicism. So I really am curious to see what he has to say on the topic when it comes to pre-sales. But yeah, I can't wait. Honestly, I think because of the fact that I'm no longer fully employed with a company, like I have the mind space now to fully focus on DemoFest. And I'm going to be like, these are the ones I'm going to be watching live,
mm-hmm.
you know, time permitting. Timing permitting, that is. But I will be obviously rewatching all of the sessions thereafter. And like, I can't, like, it's just going to be so much stuff because there's so many people that are preparing so many, like so much fantastic content to present. It's this really energizing event as well, even online, right? It's incredibly energizing to see the chat, to see people engaging with you, especially as a presenter, and just having conversations around DemoFest and the days after as well. Like people take, you know, have their outtakes, people have like their summaries, people have like so much of this content just spewing all across LinkedIn. It's fantastic to see. So it's a really, really cool event. Not as energizing, obviously, as the live ones, but hey, you know, we have to. it's the only one that both us in Europe and obviously our friends over in the US can actually come together and have this lineup of people that are both from, you know, both sides of the ocean. I'm really, really excited for that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's also worth it, and I'll say this, and I know you'll agree as someone who's speaking this year and has spoken previously, and the thing that I still remember after my DemoFest presentation, aside from the kind of weird setup that I had to do it in because I was in between jobs at the time that I did it. And I'd also just get a drop clunk, just run my ultra marathon as well the week before. So I was in a weird headspace, was actually the like 8 or 10 people who reached out on LinkedIn afterwards and said, hey, I really enjoyed your session. Nothing compares to that, right? And not on a like seeking kind of validation, but just to like, I always look at these things and go, the way I think about the podcast, right, is it's like, if something that I put out in the world has made one person think a little bit differently, that's all I'm... So don't kind of feel like you can't just send them a message. Even if you just want to say, hey, thanks so much, I really enjoyed your session, that will mean an awful lot to everybody.
We don't hear it as often as you think you do.
No.
Like the, and I'm not complaining, like, mind you, like I have gotten fantastic, you know, positive feedback from all of the sessions I've done. It's mostly because of that doubt in the back of your head of like, I don't know if I'm doing a good job. So every little positive comment sort of chips away at that, oh, I'm doing a poor job. So it's just like a little tinkering away. It's not, you know, one positive comment is not going to make it all go away. It's just, you know, a little bit at a time. So yeah, don't, the one thing, and it's, by the way, this is more of a like a life philosophy, never keep compliments back, keep criticisms back. No. If you think it's going to hurt the person. But the one thing you should never, if you see someone that, like, you know, is doing a really good job, just go and tell them. You will never sound sleazy, you will never sound like you're trying to make them, you know, to lie to them. If anything, it will make their day, right? So yeah. You know, I do this, you know, I might be a little bit on the extreme on this side, because like, I would tell people on the street that I walk by that I like their dress, right? Mm-hmm. I would do that. I am that person. But I think it's so important, because I have had, you know, the luck of having people say that to me, and it absolutely makes my day. So PSA, tell people they look amazing, or they do amazing things, or they say things that change your life, because it changes theirs.
Just yeah. And I think just one comment to add to this, and Lydia knows the kind of context where I'm coming from, and I think some of the things that are kind of have just been going on for me, right? Not me personally, but like people that I know and people that I work with. And I have one of those moments of the weekend that was just that reminder, and I think, you know, it just comes back. It's just like, you don't know what anyone else is going through, and you never know, yeah, just how much a nice comment is going to mean to somebody. Because to you, You're just going, oh, I really like your dress. But to that person, it could be the nicest thing they hear all day. So.
Yeah. Oh. Oh. I'm getting emotional here.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, join Demofest. It's happening this week that you're hearing this. And if you are hearing this and going, I haven't registered, you can go and register. And if you're thinking, oh, no, I'm not going to have time, register. You'll get access to the recordings. Absolutely. You know, and I think we will almost certainly have a Demofest debrief.
Oh, yes, for certain. That's
maybe
that's...
not the next episode because of like, recording schedules are kind of weird that we're probably going to be recording during the week of Demofest, but for sure the one after that will absolutely be a... we'll talk about Demofest a lot.
Yep, absolutely. Awesome.